Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and 3 times best-selling author here to help you by deconstructing expert guests in all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is Dr. Joan Rosenberg, the author of the book, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love, How to Master Your Difficult Feelings to Cultivate Lasting Confidence, Resilience, and Authenticity. In today's podcast, we do a deep dive into mindset on all things emotional attachments, or dealing with emotional and difficult feelings, cultivating lasting confidence, building resilience, how to ask yourself more resilient questions, and that resilient thinking mindset. So if confidence is something you struggle with, or building mental resilience is something you struggle with, or even just handling some of the negative emotions that come up, anger, sadness, grief, etc., today's podcast is going to give you so many tools to potentially help you on your journey. Not too much on the fitness side today. We talk a little bit about domain-dependent confidence when it comes to fitness and taking that into other areas of your life. But outside of that, today's episode is heavily focused on the mindset side. So without further ado, here is today's podcast with Dr. Joan Rosenberg on how to master difficult feelings to cultivate lasting confidence, resilience, and authenticity. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I am delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Joan Rosenberg. Joan Rosenberg, PhD, is a psychologist, best-selling author, corporate wellness consultant, and media expert who is known globally as an acclaimed speaker and trainer on communication, confidence, resilience, authenticity, and grief. As a 3-time TEDx speaker and member of the Association of Transformational Leaders, she has been recognized for her innovative emotional mastery and confidence-building approach, and for her thought leadership and global influence in personal development. Her latest book is 90 Seconds to a Life You Love, How to Master Your Difficult Feelings to Cultivate Lasting Confidence, Resilience, and Authenticity. And it's available now, and we'll be diving into it in today's show. Dr. Rosenberg, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. Look forward to this.
Dr. Rosenberg, your work has been considered the how-to path to developing confidence. So I want to start on that. But before we do, talk to us about kind of what got you started and prompted down your journey in this journey in the first place.
Well, boy, if the truth be told, I didn't have it. I didn't have any confidence. So, I started out in life as a pretty shy, introverted child. And I never felt like I fit in, never felt like I belonged. And, I would look over at my peers, I'd see them laughing and gathering together and just having a great time. And it was like, well, like, what do they have that I don't? And so as time went on and I began to understand that during later childhood and adolescence, I was like, oh, wait a minute, they've got confidence. I don't have that. So kind of the first question that I was wrestling with in life was, how does somebody develop confidence? Because I really wanted what they had, and so that kind of set me off on the first part of my journey. And then when I got into my professional life, I was kind of baffled by a second question, if you will. So there I was as a psychologist. I'm helping people try to change their lives. And, and I'm watching people not only struggle with how they think, I'm watching them struggle with unpleasant feelings. And so the second question came up for me. It was like, well, what makes it so difficult for people to handle unpleasant feelings? And it turns out that as the time went on, so, and I'm talking about decades, what I started to realize is that the foundational aspect of confidence is actually your ability to handle unpleasant feelings. So this answer to the second question became the answer to the first question.
I love that. And I'm working through your book at the minute, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love. And that gives me a kind of a jumping off point to a formula that's in the book. So you believe that handling difficult feelings is the foundation of feeling confident, as you mentioned there. And you use a formula to help people achieve that. Can you talk to us about the formula?
Absolutely. A colleague of mine called it the Rosenberg Reset, and it kind of stuck. And the way I think about it is the formula of 1 choice, 8 feelings, 90 seconds. So, and what I mean by that is what's the one choice? The one choice is our choice to be aware or our choice to avoid. So what does awareness look like? It's being as aware of and in touch with as much of your moment-to-moment experience as possible. You're checking in with yourself, you're noticing what's happening around you at the same time. The avoidance piece, you know, we all can recognize too. People might use substances. They might drink alcohol. They might use weed. They might shop. They might use food. There's all sorts of ways that we can check out. And so that really became kind of the second thing is, I'm sorry, is the avoidance piece is really the other choice I don't want people to be making because it's too easy to kind of check out on our lives. So the one choice is choose into awareness. The eight feelings is the second part of it, one choice, eight feelings. And the eight feelings are the unpleasant feelings that I talk about. And the eight feelings are sadness, shame, helplessness, anger, vulnerability, embarrassment, disappointment, and frustration. And so the probably the most common question I get around like the eight feelings is how come these eight? Because fear's not there, anxiety's not there. There's a lot of common things that aren't there, and I didn't put them there for many reasons. And so the reason why I chose these eight is because they're the most common everyday spontaneous reactions to things not turning out the way that we want or the way we perceive they need to be for us. So it's the everydayness of them. And you can think of in a given, you know, day, week, month, how frequently you might feel one or more of these feelings. So like I said, it's really the commonness of them. And then the third part is the 90 seconds piece is really the method piece of it all. And so, again, my big question is what made it so difficult for people to handle unpleasant feelings? And as the neuroscience research started to come out in the late 1990s and well into the early 2000s, what people were talking about more and more was, first of all, that we're one interconnected whole. We're not a brain that is totally separated from a body and it, you know, this brain body thing. We're in an interconnected whole. The brain is always feeding information to the body. The body's always feeding information to the brain. And it turns out that most of us come to know what we feel emotionally through bodily sensation. Now that's kind of an interesting, like that to me was a super interesting awareness or insight. And so it's like, well, why is that meaningful? Because so many of us try to cut off from our bodies. So even if you think about something like embarrassment, for instance, I would feel the heat of the blood rushing to my face, but you would see the redness. So the heat is the bodily sensation in this case. And so the other thing that happened is that Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, she's a Harvard-trained neuroscientist, she made this observation that when a feeling gets triggered, that there's this rush of biochemicals into the bloodstream that actually activate the bodily sensations, and they flush out of the bloodstream in roughly an upper limit of 90 seconds. So in my head, it's, you know, I was always telling people to ride the wave, ride the rave, ride the rave. Well, what I didn't understand is that I was telling them to ride the bodily sensation waves of feeling. And that's what I also realized is that's what people were freaking out about. It's like that's what people didn't want to feel. It's not that we didn't want to feel the whole range of what we felt. It's that we didn't want to feel the bodily sensations that helped us know what we were feeling emotionally. And if I could tell people that all they had to do was ride one or more short-lived bodily sensation waves, then they'd go, oh, 90 seconds, I can do that. And people were now willing to lean into handling unpleasant feelings. So again, it's one choice, awareness, eight feelings, the ones I named, and then your ability to ride one or more short-lived bodily sensation waves that allows you to actually lean into the whole full range of what we feel.
Do you find that people struggle with the awareness around feelings? So when I was going through the eight in the book, I was kind of trying to bring myself back to an earlier point in my life where I struggled to either bring awareness and identify things like shame in particular. Anger was an obvious one. I was able to, if you got angry, you could feel it. It was there. But there was other ones that I struggled with. Do you find people struggle with the awareness element of it?
They do. And part of that is some of what happens early in life is that we shut down when we're hurt. And so we practice disconnecting Well, if we've practiced disconnecting, then what we're practicing disconnecting from is we're disconnecting from our awareness of what's happening in our body, right? And so sometimes, to your point, for instance, let's say you got really practiced at anger, but you didn't get really practiced at disappointment or sadness because it felt so uncomfortable, mm-hmm. right? So you sort of created this default path to anger. And now you realize that, well, maybe anger is not the lead feeling. It's actually disappointment that's the lead feeling, but it's taken me a whole lot longer to get to that. Why? Because you practiced overriding it for so long. So part of what sometimes it's going to take is increasing your awareness of when you're having different reactions to try to start to notice how they're showing up, kind of how, what, where they're showing up in your body so that you can start to make those stronger links.
That's brilliant. And I think something that I experienced and that I've connected with this when I was reading the book, I struggled with feeling sadness for a long period of time. I kind of grew up in the west of Ireland, farmer background, you don't cry, you're a man, mm-hmm. man up. And so I really struggled until even my 30s of even connecting with that emotion and feeling. And it felt so foreign. It felt like speaking Japanese, trying to right. connect with that feeling. And right. and I think that awareness, as you said, brings, it's just getting people to check in, well, what's actually going on? And I think, as you said, the eight feelings bring it back. I want to touch on anger as well, because thankfully this is something that I've been better with in recent years. I always turned my anger internal. It was never projected outwards. But you speak about it in the book about how it's complicated. People express anger and people do anger, and that escalating anger, conflict is a decision. Talk to us about what that means.
Oh, boy, this was a couple of different important awarenesses for me. First of all, we can use default feelings, to your point, so that if we don't want to feel something that feels more vulnerable and harder to handle, sometimes we'll shut down on that and like we'll default to anger, like you were talking about. And what I realized is that there's a difference between expressing anger and doing anger. So anything that is escalation, if I start to raise my voice, or I start to be mean, or I start to curse, or I start to throw things, or become enraged, in my mind, every bit of that is doing anger. It's not expressing anger. And people confuse rage and anger. And so it's like, if all I have to do, frankly, is look at you and say, you know what? That made me really angry. And I can say it in that tone and deliver it in that way. And that's expressing anger. But if I start to escalate, now I'm doing anger. And I really want to make that kind of that first distinction that anything that is escalated is actually going to cause the person listening to feel less safe in even attempting to hear your anger. So the more you can deliver it in a way that is caring and yet firm and straightforward without escalation, the more someone is going to be able to hear your anger. So the big distinction between doing anger and expressing anger is any escalation is doing it. And I don't want that. I want to encourage people to express as opposed to do. The second thing for me was really quite interesting. I was seeing a couple, and the woman was being withdrawn in the relationship, and the guy was being much more imposing and threatening. He hadn't acted out physically in any way, but he came from a very abusive background. But he thought nothing of being sarcastic and mean and raising his voice. And I looked at him and I said, do you do this at work? And he went, no. He's kind of looking at me somewhat puzzled. And I said, really, you don't do this at work? He goes, no. I said, how come? And he is like, because I just got promoted. I'm a supervisor. I want to be a good role model. I don't want to get fired. I mean, he named like four or five different things right off the bat. And I sort of repeated it again. I said, so you really don't do this? No, don't do it at work. And I said, that's so interesting. I said, if you don't do it at work, but you're allowing yourself to do it at home, you've got two different kind of standards operating for yourself here. And the reality is if you can control yourself at work, surely you can control yourself at home. It's a decision. And And so it was like, you know, my image was like I was taking my two fingers and kind of poking him in the eyes a little bit. But it was like all of a sudden he had this kind of awakening. And I looked at him and I challenged him. And I said, if you don't do this at work, then you can actually make the decision to no longer do this at home. And I'm going to challenge you to begin tonight.
You give me a really good point that I want to unpack for people. I've called it in the past domain dependent confidence, meaning that you can take one area of your life that you're confident in and apply that same belief system to another area. As a fitness person, you're good in the gym, you take it into your business, you take it into your family life. Did you find for him and in other people's, in your experience working with people, there's that domain dependence control where they are nearly taking a point or an aspect of life where they do show that composure or that control or emotional strength, and then they're applying it in another direction or in another area?
Well, yeah, actually, your insight about that is actually super important because not everybody thinks about doing that. So to help them see that they can take an area of experience or an area of expertise or an area of mastery and they can apply it to a different aspect of their life is actually really, really important. But not everybody thinks about that. So yes, so your example of applying kind of that fitness idea to different domains of your life is that's awesome. And that's really what I was doing. I was looking for, I'm always looking for areas of life where people are successful. So that they can literally do what you just described, is that they can draw on that area of success and then they can apply it as many places across the board as possible.
Why do you think people struggle so much to do that? Is it just a faulty wiring in terms of their thought process and their programming, or is it something else that holds them back from that?
You know, I just don't, that's an interesting question. I don't know that people are always thinking with the intention of having awareness and insight about themselves. So that they do something, they get good at something, but they think they're just good at that.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily generating the kinds of questions or generating the kinds of insights within themselves to develop and grow more fully across the board as a person. So it takes somebody who's interested in their own growth and increasing their own insight and their own awareness to be able to go, oh, wait a minute, you know, I got good at this. I can draw on this experience over there too. But you have to want to have that insight and that awareness about yourself to do that. And the more awareness and insight you have like that, typically the more masterful you become in many different aspects of your life.
I think that's so helpful. It reminds me, I think it's an old Japanese swordsman, that to see greatness in one is to see it in all, that you can, if you're able to see mastery in one thing, you can apply it to others. Emotional strength is something else that you talk about in the book, and it's part of confidence. What goes into developing emotional strength? And I loved this section as somebody that probably struggled in the earlier part of my life with emotional composure and just mastering some of those emotions that would come up, and I've got better with it. I like to think I've got a little bit better with it in recent years. But talk to us about the importance of developing emotional strength and how that applies and impacts confidence.
Well, for me, there's two main components of it. And I'll tell you why I went the one direction too with it. It's like nobody was ever talking about emotional strength. And it was like, well, what is emotional strength? And so for me, it's comprised of two main things. One we've already begun to talk about. So your ability or your capacity to handle those 8 unpleasant feelings, that's what I describe as feeling capable in the world. And what I found here is that if somebody did not handle those 8 unpleasant feelings well, they actually didn't feel very capable of handling life. They felt like they would get bowled over by life, or that they were unsuccessful, or that disappointments would knock them off their feet. So that they just didn't feel very capable of handling life. So the first part of emotional strength is seeing yourself as having that ability or that capacity to handle those 8 unpleasant feelings. Again, none of us like them, but we just got to get good at handling, even at being comfortably, like handling them comfortably well. So the second part had to do with how much I watched people or how often I listened to people talk about not wanting to be a burden to others and not asking for help. And I was like, this is backwards. And so I was trying to find a way to turn our capacity to ask for help or our willingness to ask for help into a strength. And I was like, oh, well, actually, this is strength. So there's a little story, which I'm happy to share if you're interested, around this very idea. But the second part of emotional strength is your willingness to acknowledge needs and limitations and then to ask for help. And so asking for help and handling the 8 unpleasant feelings to me are the two things that comprise emotional strength. So one is feeling capable. That's the 8 unpleasant feelings. And the second one is being resourceful. And that's the asking for help.
Yeah, we might come back to the story because something else I wanted to unpack, and you've given me kind of a stepping stone to it there, where you're speaking about confidence and speaking up and how that relates to confidence. But an area that jumped out massively to me, something I really struggled with is harsh self-criticism. And I know there's a lot of people listening to the podcast who struggle with confidence. I like to think of confidence on my side, it's like giving to yourself and taking away from yourself, like repeatedly keeping promises to yourself. For me, builds my confidence over time, being a harsh self-critic and constantly badgering and hammering myself knocks my confidence over time. It's kind of like this pendulum I find that I need to get balanced on the right side, not too much of harsh criticism and positively setting small goals and hitting those targets. But a lot of people struggle with that self-criticism when it comes to pursuing goals, dreams, on whatever it is that they're looking to do. What's your take on harsh self-criticism in terms of, is there a place for it? Is it something that's completely destructive? Or what do you recommend to people?
I'm actually going to tell you, I want you to ditch the whole thing. I don't want you to keep one iota of harsh self-criticism. I don't. I think it's highly destructive. And I think it is singularly one of the most damaging things we ever do to ourselves. And for me, doubt is a form of harsh self-criticism. So what's the deal with harsh self-criticism? This is so interesting to me as well, that I was working with a graduate student. I was at a university as a staff psychologist, and I kept on listening to this student talk about his frustration and dealing with certain things, and then all of a sudden he would shift it over into how worthless, undeserving, and inadequate he was. And I was like, I was shaking my head. It was like, how did you get from this to that? And then what dawned on me is that harsh self-criticism is a thought hijack of those 8 unpleasant feelings. So think of it this way. We're not in charge of what we feel or how we feel. It's a spontaneous reaction. And we can manage it or control it once it's in our awareness. But we can't do anything with it until it's in our awareness. And what I began to watch over time is that when people engaged in harsh self-criticism, they were doing it to get away from unpleasant feelings. And so the unpleasant feelings were what they couldn't control, but their thinking they could control. So if we can control our thinking, then we can be harsh and mean to ourselves with great intensity. We can do it mildly. We can do it for 5 minutes. We can do it for 5 hours. We can, so that what I began to see is that harsh self-criticism was robbing or hijacking the unpleasant feeling experience we didn't want to be having. And again, real quick example here is doing an interview, and the interviewer could not hear me, I could hear him. So he's working the chords, he's playing with the computer, he's down on his knees. Like, I was like, you can picture him trying to figure out where the problem was. And I hear him say, I'm so embarrassed. But without missing a beat, the next two lines were, I'm so stupid, I'm such an idiot. Now, that's the thought hijack. If he just said, I'm so embarrassed, I was like, okay, what, big deal, who cares, right? I'm chilling, it's cool. But the moment after he said, "I'm so embarrassed," he thought hijacked it by going, "I'm so stupid, I'm such an idiot." And that's how quickly it occurs for us. And but again, I'm emphatic about this. I think it's one of the most damaging things that you can do. And there's no equivalence here. Harsh self-criticism is not equal to unpleasant feelings. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the earthquake Richter scale. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Okay. I lived in San Francisco for a while. I had a couple of earthquakes while I was there.
Okay, good. So the interesting thing about the Richter scale is that it's a 10-point scale, but a 1-point difference is not a 1-point difference. It's a 10 times difference. So what I like to do is to think about unpleasant feelings is 1-to-1. I feel something unpleasant, it's unpleasant. But the moment you get engaged in harsh self-criticism, think of whatever you're doing as at the minimum 10 times worse.
Yeah.
So, and I, you know, if I really go out on a limb here and kind of take a leap, I actually think that harsh self-criticism is a big piece of what takes people down to suicidality. So I'm adamant about people stopping harsh self-criticism. And how do you do it? You notice that you're engaging in it, and then you ask yourself. You want to, almost like putting a car in reverse. You want to kind of stop and you go, all right, what was going on for me just a few moments before I started to be mean to myself? And what was I feeling? What was hard for me to think, know, feel, or bear? And the moment you get to that, then what do? You go back to riding those waves of unpleasantness. And that's how you figure it out. But I'm gonna challenge you to stop the harsh self-criticism. There's no need for it.
I've got better with it.
Good. And I'm gonna say, ditch it.
Yeah, like it, which gives me a nice little jumping off point to letting go. But just what you said there, it's a very slippery slope. Like I was a suicidal teenager, so I remember what those thoughts were like, those you're an idiot, you're stupid, you can't do anything. Like that was the slippery slope that led to, what should I just end my life? What's the point of being here? And it's very important that you pull yourself back from that, because again, now that's an extreme example, but the fact that that's where in my brain the logical next step goes shows that that's something you need to be very aware of and mindful of, even just in the people around you, if not in your own life. But you've given me that letting go, something that, again, similar to a lot of the things we've talked about, I think I've got a bit better with in recent years, but there's people listening to this podcast who really struggle to let go of either difficult life experiences or whatever it is that they're going on. In my case, the harsh self-criticism, still a work in progress. But you talk about it being that these experiences are disguised grief. Talk to us about that.
I'm grateful for the observations. So think of disguised grief as a gap, a grief that's occurred because there's a gap. And there's a gap between what we desired, what we dreamed of, what we wanted, what we needed, and what we really got. And so it's kind of in that gap is the grief. But I think of just this, so the first thing to do is understand what I mean by grief. I think of grief as sadness, helplessness, anger, and disappointment at the minimum. So it's 4 of the 8 feelings that I've talked about. But it was like, all right, then how do I understand where disguised grief shows up? And so it shows up for me kind of in 2 major ways. One, I identify disguised grief through what I call grief signal words. And then I identify disguised grief tied to these difficult life experiences by using kind of 5 different categories of grieving. And so what do the grief signal words sound like? They sound like longstanding anger, bitterness, holding grudges, resentment, pessimism, cynicism, jealousy, envy. I mean, the list is actually kind of fairly long. So think of the toxic versions of feelings that we have And I will guarantee you that underneath that is some grief. So one of the ways you can know that you've got disguised grief is if you're a person that does something like is resentful and bitter or holds grudges or wants to get revenge, or then you're somebody who's got grief that's kind of buried underneath and is important to pay attention to. The second way is through these categories. And so what I began to see, if somebody's in long-term therapy, what I began to see therapy as is a long-term kind of grieving process. And what I began to understand that people were doing is that they were grieving over what they got and didn't deserve. So think of that as harsh treatment, as they grew up in a chaotic household, or they experienced some measure of abuse as they were growing up. Or they were grieving over what they deserved and didn't get. So in this case, it would be the good stuff. The first one's the bad stuff. The second one's the good stuff. So not enough praise, not enough support, not enough encouragement, nobody showing up for swimming meets or soccer games or any kind of dance competition or whatever it might have been, right? That there wasn't encouragement around progress. So that's grieving over what we got and didn't deserve, and grieving over what we deserved and didn't get. And then the next three are grieving over what never was. So kind of the lost opportunities or the facts and circumstances of your early life, grieving over what is not now, which would be kind of the facts and circumstances of your current life, and then grieving over what may never be. So it's may sound kind of heavy, but the reality is that there's really a lot of ways that people can deal with where all this grief is, and that they can come out of it, come through it, and actually be much better, feel much better, feel lighter and much clearer.
How do you recommend, I know the book goes through this, so I'll be linking it in the description for everybody listening, 90 Seconds to a Life You Love, but how do you recommend for those who are listening now who want to release that pain of those difficult life experiences or that story they're holding on to? What would be kind of the 0 to 1? Is it the awareness of being the first step and then going from there, or is it something else?
There's more to it. Awareness is always the first step, so that's great. And what I would say is, if somebody listening is to pick out a particular life experience that was hard, and then in the book, and also there's in my second TED talk, if people want to go to that as well, there's a number of different questions that I encourage people to kind of go through. And here's the real essence of it. What I want people to do is to make sense of the impact and meaning any given experience had on them across time. Meaning, so let's say, let's go back. I was bullied as a child, right? And so actually over a long period of my childhood and adolescence. So now if I want to make sense of that experience, then the first thing I want to do is to make sense of how it impacted me. Again, this idea across time, how did it impact me when I first started out? And it made me shyer and more withdrawn, and I had more shut down and those kinds of things. And how did it impact me as I aged? I was a bit of that for a while, and then I realized that I didn't want to stay shut down, and I had to figure stuff out. Or how is it impacting me now? Well, it's not. It's become, so what it became for me in terms of making sense of the bullying experience as an example was that I came to the awareness at some point as I started to think about this stuff and try to make my way through it, and the impact it had on me was that I never wanted to do to somebody what they'd done to me. And so I started to choose kindness as one of my highest values. So now what I'm, because I'm reflecting on it, and trying to understand the impact and meaning it had for me, now I get to start to turn the experience around, right? So there's these questions about, again, how, what's the impact and meaning it had for you across time, when it happened, as you aged, and now, and then what you do is you try to extract the good. So what good came out of this? And the reality is, you know, some people are going, well, I was abused. There's nothing good that came out of it. Well, that's actually probably not entirely true. Lots of people, for instance, who grew up in abusive homes stayed at school more. And they got more engaged in their schoolwork and they got more engaged in extracurricular activities. And because of that, they became more social and in some ways more successful in life because they got so good at those other things. Well, that's not a desired outcome out of, right? Nobody planned for that. Yeah. But there may be some good that can be extracted from still painful experiences. So the next step would be to extract the good. And then after you extract the good, that's when I think you can forgive. And in this case, it's forgiving yourself for what you did or did not know or did or did not do. And it's also forgiving the others around you for what they did or did not know and what they did or did not do. And again, my thinking is you get to the forgiveness step after you've made sense of the impact an experience has had. And then the beauty of this is that you get to put behind you your old life story. And you get to choose a new life story. So the question then at that point becomes, who do I want to be? Who do I want to become? You know, what values do I want to live by? How do I want to show up? What kind of person do I want to be? What kind of friend or partner or whatever do I want to be? So you actually get to do what I call forge new images of who you want to become. So the last part of it, once you've extracted the good, is that you forgive, you free yourself from your old life story, and you get to forge new images of who you want to become.
I love that. And it ties in beautifully with that going towards your authentic self.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, it reminds me, like I always think when I'm trying to make my decisions, I'm pulling from two sides. That authentic self is on one side and that ego is on the other side. The conditioning, the culture, the society, the experiences in my life, the traumas, all of that are over here on the ego side. And then the authentic self is your gratitude, your love, your focus on all the positive emotions. And you're like, it pulls in both directions weirdly. And you just have to choose, well, I'm going to move in this direction. I think that awareness, and as you said, changing that story can go a long way. As someone who's felt the benefit of it, can go a long way towards helping you reach that authentic self. I think the final step with authentic self confidence, and there's this resilience sandwiched into the middle, because I think it's a multiple pronged approach when it comes to, you know, getting a life and building a life that you love, you know, 90 seconds to a life you love in your own words when it comes to the book. But talk to us about resilience and how learning to be resilient is something that we can develop, because I think, and I've had this misconception in the past as well, Dr. Rosenberg, that there's resilient people out there, that negative story, or re-choose my words, that misaligned version of reality, that there's resilient people out there, that it's not something they developed, it's just something they have or something they are, which is a huge misconception. Talk to us about how we can develop resilience, and that it's actually, in my language, a skill that you can develop. But talk to us about learning resiliency.
Oh, absolutely. So it is absolutely a skill you can develop. I don't, you know, there are certain experiences that we have in life that help us be more resilient, or if we're taught that, that makes a big difference. But anybody, if you have a good thinking brain, then you can learn it. And you can develop the skills around it. So here's how I look at it. Again, the first two basic parts of it are, one is you can handle unpleasant feelings. I'm right back to the eight unpleasant feelings, and that you have the sense of yourself as being able to handle those eight unpleasant feelings. You're going to feel more capable. That's a foundational piece of resilience. Second, we've also already talked about, and that is that you can ask for help. So that you don't falsely believe that you should be going and doing things by yourself. The reality is none of us succeeds alone. We always succeed with the help of other people. So like get used to it and be willing to lean into that, because part of the beauty of our life experience is also our willingness to kind of let others be part of the journey. So the second is to ask for help. There's really a lot of basic other kind of foundational things that are very common. So getting good sleep, getting good nutrition, to your point about fitness, good fitness and exercise, sunlight, supplements, whatever, all those different kinds of things. We can throw that in that helps foster resilience. We can add in things like faith and prayer and meditation or any kind of martial art or something that puts you in a contemplative space. All those kinds of things support resilience. But here's the other thing that, that I really want to highlight, and it's what I call developing resilient thinking. And here's, again, here's the beauty of it, because you can tailor make it for yourself. You've got all these different things that you can do that I've just named that are all part of building resilience. But part of it is also in your attitudes and beliefs, kind of the attitudes and beliefs you hold, and the kind of questions that you ask yourself. And so that's what I talk about in terms of resilient questions or resilient thinking. So what am I talking about way of attitudes and beliefs? Well, I can hold the belief that every life experience is a learning experience. Or something we talked about earlier is that, I'm really good at this one thing, and I persevered through trying to develop that skill. I can take that same energy and I can apply it over here. So I can hold the attitude and belief that I have the ability to persevere in the face of hard times. I can, there's just so many. So the thing that I would raise here is, what kind of attitudes and beliefs can you hold that will help you sustain yourself? And so another one that I was told early on is that the people who never make it are those who quit. So my attitude and belief is, I'm not quitting. I'm just going to persevere, period, end of story. And so holding that belief, even when I'm in my most frustrated states, helps me go forward. Then the other part is what I would call resilient questions. And again, the beauty of it is you get to create it for yourself. So a good example is like when the whole COVID experience started, it was like, all right, who do I want to become? So that was a question that I asked myself. Or how can I take what I'm going through and turn it into positive learning for me? Again, how do I want to show up? The idea here is you can ask yourself questions that invite you to be more than you are right now. And you raise that question for your brain to wrestle with. And that also facilitates resilience. So how am I going to develop the strength to persevere? What life experience can I draw on that will help sustain me? Right? You can make up any question you want to make up that helps you become more than the person you are in the moment. Every bit of that helps facilitate resilience.
I love that. One of my mentors used to tell me that your quality of life will be determined by the quality of your questions. And I think, as you said, putting those better questions when it comes to resilient thinking and resilient questions is so important. And yes, your book goes through so much, like it's broken into three different parts, the skills building at the beginning, the avoiding pitfalls, and then going through speaking your truth all the way down to committing to your true self. So for anyone that wants to dive into that, I highly recommend it. If anything we've spoken about today connects with you, if mastering those difficult feelings, cultivating lasting confidence, resilience, and authenticity is a goal of yours, then these are where the tools there. Dr. Rosenberg, I can't thank you enough for your time, for all the energy and effort for putting this book together. And I know how many people it's going to help when it comes to particularly those who struggle with those difficult feelings, because I think that's the 0 to 1, as you said, that awareness and checking in with those triggers, because a lot of it, from my own kind of past experience, happens on automatic and you've reacted and then you're like, oh, I was emotionally triggered there. And we never do that reflection or self-awareness on it. And then we don't learn from it. Again, speaking from personal and firsthand experience. Your book brings people straight through that journey.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm glad that you're enjoying it.
I definitely am. And for everybody listening, as I said, I will link the book in the show notes on BrianKeenFitness.com. People can link in, and wherever you're listening to your podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, you can click straight through. The book link could be there. But Dr. Rosenberg, is there anywhere else you'd like to send people to the website, your Instagram page, or is there anywhere else or any other resources that you think people should check out alongside the book?
I was doing quite a bit on Instagram. That would be a place to go back to. And it's Dr. Joan Rosenberg. Most of my handles are Dr. Joan Rosenberg, and the other would be certainly my website, and that drjoanrosenberg.com.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, I will link those in the show notes and in the description for today's podcast. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you so much again for your time, and I'll chat to you again real soon.
That sounds great. Thanks so much.
There you have it, Dr. Joan Rosenberg on how to master difficult feelings to cultivate lasting confidence, resilience, and authenticity. That is all from this week's episode. If you want a little bit more, for those of you who are email people and are email subscribers and are a fan of reading, I would definitely check out my weekly newsletter, which breaks down my top three takeaways and my three main points of thinking that week from the podcast. So looking forward to doing it this week. To get and on my and join my email list, just head over to BrianKeenFitness.com and click on the email list section there, and on any of the Instagram links or bio links on my social media, just click in, join my email list, put your email in there, and every Thursday you will get my top three takeaways and my main three thinking points for that week. That's all for me from this week's podcast. Catch you all next Monday.